Welcome back to the Griffith Small Podcast. My name is Azan.
And my name's Katia. Today, we're thrilled to have Dr. Elizabeth Nglezos, a lecturer at Griffith Law School, join us to discuss privacy and data protection laws in the digital space. Dr. Nglezos specializes in data, privacy, and the law of consent, and we are honored to have her share her expertise with us today.
With the rise of social media and other digital platforms, privacy and data protection have become increasingly complex issues. It can be challenging to navigate the space, especially with evolving technologies and emerging digital developments. So we're grateful to have Dr. Nglezos here to help us make sense of it all. Welcome, Liz. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me.
Would you mind giving us some insight into the focus of your doctoral thesis and what motivated you to pursue research in the area of digital technologies and their impact on individuals?
Sure. So I'm going to try and keep this brief because I have a lot of thoughts on this. But my doctoral thesis I called Hyperconnection, Law and the Digital Influence on Individual Identity. And basically this all came about because I ended up buying a unicorn t-shirt. Well, I was shopping for a gift with a unicorn theme for a niece, but I started to get bombarded with ads with unicorns because I'd typed unicorn gifts into my Google search. As I was doing that, I was also looking for shoes, all of those sort of incidental things that you do as a course of your daily activities. So I started to get ads that linked the Adidas logo and unicorns. Then I started to get ads to do with Wonder Woman because I'd made a mention on Facebook of how great I thought the Wonder Woman movie was for young girls to see. So eventually I had this perfect conglomeration of all three where I had Wonder Woman walking a unicorn instead of a dog, and it said, sorry, can't, I need to walk my unicorn. And as a mad dog lover and passionate dog mother, I thought that was fantastic. Of course I wasn't going to buy it, but eventually after being bombarded with the ad, very subtly, it was just kind of constantly appearing at the right-hand side of my Google searches, I eventually gave in and bought it. In the end, I wore it somewhere in a casual setting, but with professional acquaintances, and felt very, very embarrassed by it. And I felt duped. I felt like I'd been tricked. And that was why I wanted to work out, why is this legal? How did this happen? Why isn't the law protecting me from being tricked into buying something I actually never wanted? And that's why I wanted to look into it. So that's what precipitated the whole thing.
Thank you for that introduction, Liz. So one of the key questions you consider in your work is, what is privacy in a space where real value comes from your visibility to others? Would you mind discussing how the digital space has changed the nature of privacy and personal data protection?
Sure. Look, as far as privacy is concerned, privacy itself is a real issue because we really don't have a clear definition of what privacy is. And as you said in your question, the issue is, of course, that we talk about privacy as something that we want to have, but we seem to give it away every opportunity we get. There's this urge to display ourselves for other people all of the time. And every time we do that, we create data, and we create data that other people can use. So I guess my focus on privacy is really about, well, firstly, I think privacy is the wrong focus. I don't think we need to focus on privacy anymore. I think we need to focus on the data and what is being done with that data. And so we need to forget about the consent as such, and just focus on what should they be allowed to do with our data.
So do you feel as though privacy may be an outdated notion?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a huge issue and a huge limitation with the way we approach law in the first place. And you only have to look at the Australian Privacy Act to show that we really don't seem to prioritise it anyway. But no, we are giving up our privacy just as quickly as we are claiming that we want it. And so it's a pretty meaningless notion.
So in light of these conclusions about the concept of privacy, Liz, could you run us through the current legal protections for individual data and privacy in Australia? And what are some of the shortfalls of these protections?
Good question. So basically in our Privacy Act, a Commonwealth Privacy Act, what we're really focusing on is keeping data away from other people. So if an organisation stores your data, there are certain principles that they have to follow with what data they store. And these sort of guidelines are basically developed based on the OECD guidelines that most countries have implemented. But basically, That's the extent of the privacy protections that we have in Australia. So if somebody stores your data, how do they have to keep it? And under what circumstances are they allowed to record your data? But there is no express right to privacy in Australia. What we are seeing, though, as part of the general data protection regulation in the EU, is an increasing move towards regulating privacy protections supranationally. So we have certain obligations now if we want to engage with EU data. And that sort of, to me, as an academic who works in this area, to me, that has a greater impact on what we can do with data now in Australia than perhaps what we can do under our own Privacy Act.
So in light of our own Privacy Act's shortcomings and in the absence of an express right to privacy, as the High Court established in Lena Game Meets, how effective do you think the current privacy and data protection laws in Australia are, Liz, at protecting individuals' personal information?
So, look, in theory, the idea is that the data is well protected, that other people can't access it. Now, we've seen, you know, data breaches where that is obviously, despite, you know, best efforts, someone has been able to get access to that data and potentially use it for nefarious purposes. The difficulty is going to be, to me, that when we regulate or legislate to say these are the limits of what you can do with people's data, obviously our nefarious actors are not the ones that are going to be following the letter of the law in the first place. So we have to kind of acknowledge that. And I think that sort of should fall more into the domain of cybersecurity rather than being about privacy per se. So I think as far as what privacy needs to do here is really focus on protecting the individual from sort of undue influence or undue inference about them. If we have enough data about us that can be used to predict something about a person or infer something about them that they would not want you to know, to me, that's a bigger issue with privacy. But privacy can't address that because essentially it's not that their privacy has been breached. That comes down to what has happened as a result of them getting access to your data and doing something different with it.
That's really interesting. Sorry to backtrack you, but you mentioned the GDPR earlier. Would you mind explaining what the GDPR is and what are some of its key protections? And how do these differ from existing privacy and data protection laws in Australia?
The GDPR is really brilliant. So it is an EU-wide piece of legislation, European Union-wide piece of legislation. And what it did was it set out some very strict standards as far as what data is and what data qualifies for protection. The interesting thing about the GDPR, or General Data Protection Regulation, is that it also has what's called extraterritorial application. So this means that even a company in Australia can be required to comply with those general data protection regulations. So the key thing for me was they gave a clear definition of what consent meant, and they also introduced a clear protection against profiling, you know, classifying someone as falling into a particular group and then making decisions on them based on that. It also created the right to be forgotten. So you can request that your data is erased. And that was quite groundbreaking. It also made life difficult for the United States at the time as well.
I can imagine. So focusing in on that key issue of consent, how do legal frameworks surrounding consent and informed consent impact the regulation of digital influence? And what reforms do you feel are necessary, Liz, to ensure that consent is meaningful in the digital age?
Good question. Look, it's so many people talk about consent and how to fix consent. But at the end of the day, I think we can sum up the value of consent in one simple anecdote. So I apologize to Harvard and Yale if I've got them around the wrong way. But there was an example where they had first-year law students, or that may have been slightly later in their degree, and they asked these students to test a new social media platform. Okay, and as part of that, they had to go through the, you know, the original, the I agree, and then get on the social media platform and do it. And these are, you know, students at the top law school in the United States, you know, some would say potentially one of the top in the world. And in those, the terms and conditions was a clause that said In exchange for access to this platform, you agree to give us your firstborn child. Now, of course, that would not be enforceable, but the point being that even the best legal scholars don't read the terms and conditions. So one of the things they tried to address in the GDPR is that the terms and conditions need to be really transparent and accessible, but that this is still going to be an issue called what they refer to as a disclosure overload. So terms and conditions, even if it's well motivated, they tend to get longer and longer and longer. And they suggest that if you actually sat and read all of these, you would literally never have time to engage with any of the services you're ascribing to. So that is the issue with consent. And informed consent is absolutely a fallacy because we don't have the time to be informed. And there's also has to be choice there. So a lot of these social media platforms and things that rely on data are infrastructural for us now. So for us to opt out of Messenger or WhatsApp or, you know, Twitter, if you're a nerd like me, you're actually missing something really important that adds value to your life. So do you actually have free choice? And consent needs to be given as a matter of free choice. So I think it's useless. It's not valuable anymore. So that's, there's no way to fix consent, in my opinion.
Thanks for sharing that, Liz. It's honestly quite scary hearing that consent is obsolete in the digital space. So in the absence of consent, what recommendations would you give to individuals who wish to protect their personal data and privacy while maintaining control over their digital identities?
So that's a really good question because I'm also a bit of a data fatalist. I think they're going to get the data regardless. So on one hand, I think is this where we really need to be focusing. But then on the other hand, we do have some great privacy scholars that are working in this space that are creating new search engines and platforms and things that might help reduce your data trail. But at the end of the day, I do like that when I go looking for news, that my browser knows I prefer this particular website. So there's a convenience trade-off as well. How can you protect your privacy? How can you protect your data? I don't know that you can. And that's, I guess, the concern. So we need to, and that's why I argue that we need to regulate what is done with data by other people. That is what we need to be focusing on, regulating what sort of algorithms, what processes can we use, and what is the output we want to stop.
So before we start to wrap things up, how can journalists and media outlets, in your opinion, Liz, balance the public interest in accessing information alongside the need to protect individuals' privacy and data?
Oh, it's such a good question. Okay, I might sound like I'm a staunch advocate for privacy, but I'm also a staunch advocate for free speech. And I think it's really important that journalists do their job and are allowed to raise a concern if they think something is worth bringing to the public attention. And that comes back to journalistic standards as well and, you know, the quality of your information and all of those sort of things. To be perfectly honest, I don't want my journalists to be worried about the privacy of other people if it's fairly gained information. And this is an important part, okay, because it goes back to your earlier question about ABC and Lena Game Meets and the fact that the High Court said definitively we do not have a right to privacy in Australia. And I actually think that's kind of important. There are other protections that can apply. So we can talk about breach of confidence, okay, under tort law. So maybe somebody has been expressed information to someone else in a setting where they expected it to be treated with confidentiality. So there's a protection for that in place. We have defamation. So you can't make a defamatory statement, you know, except in very limited circumstances. So we have to be able to balance free speech with those things. But I don't think privacy necessarily fixes it.
So just to conclude, Liz, in light of all we've discussed, what are some of the key legal and ethical considerations you would highlight that journalists and media outlets need to take into account when reporting on issues related to privacy and data protection?
That's a really interesting question because if I think about it, it's an important idea if you think of journalism as an opportunity to help people reframe things. I don't think the public's served by thinking that they actually have privacy and that people can't get their data if they want it anyway, because realistically, nothing we do is as secure as we think it's going to be. So perhaps if we looked at journalism as something that sort of aimed to do a public service, then perhaps what journalism could be thinking about doing is talking about the reality of our data being out there. And the TikTok example is particularly interesting because I think there's a lot of, in my opinion, a definite sub-theme of China are the bad guys, this is a Chinese company, and at the same time Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, or now Meta, because they had to rebrand because their public perception was so bad, is sitting there lobbying Congress to enter into this inquiry, which is just mind-blowing, right? I do understand the concern about having, you know, people in sensitive public offices and having certain social media platforms on their devices, but it's not only TikTok that's going to be getting all of that information. I guess the media could offer an important counterbalance by talking about the reality of Meta having the same data. Meta owns everything now, so yeah.
Indeed they do, but I suspect that's not a reality that will keep people scrolling. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to end the discussion here because we've run out of time. That being said, we're incredibly appreciative for your time and willingness to share your expertise on our podcast today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Inglesos. Your insights have been incredibly valuable.
Yeah, thank you. I've really enjoyed the discussion. I think there's so much to work on here, but it's interesting.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. We hope you found this episode informative and thought-provoking. Be sure to tune in next time for more discussions on important legal issues.